Did you hear that Instagram got bought by Facebook?
I did. I just saw somebody post a link to Instaport, which will take all your photos off of Instagram.
And do what with them?
And you can put them on your hard drive and maybe a couple other places. I didn't quite see the whole rest of the story. But there's already things coming out like that in the wake of this announcement.
What do you think about the announcement?
I think it's really sad. I think Instagram's going to lose its cool cred. Facebook is definitely not cool on the same level that Instagram is. And I think it's going to be probably a pretty swift death for them.
Really? You really think? Well, I mean, in terms of their cool, right? But in terms of them being bolted onto the Facebook photo sharing?
I give them 18 months to 2 years, and I think Facebook will strip what's good and integrate the features and get rid of the brand, get rid of the name, get rid of the service, and just take the parts of it and integrate it into Facebook. But they will keep their brand name and get rid of Instagram. That's what I would do if I was Facebook. I wouldn't want another brand attached to mine. I would buy them, suck them dry, and, you know, discard them, which is what those tech companies do.
They do
and
that to a lot of companies that
I
they
mean,
buy.
So here's the other option is Facebook might want to earn some cred back and actually keep their word and let them, you know, keep them from not shutting down. Oh, poor little Instagram. And support them and really let it flourish on its own and just have an integration into Facebook. But I don't see them doing that.
Yeah, I think that Facebook and Instagram merging is sort of like, what if Twitter and SoundCloud merged or something? Like it doesn't, or what if, that's not even a good example. Like, what if, you know, I'm on a few different networks. What if like YouTube and SoundCloud merged? Like, they're two different things. Like, one's, you know, video, the other's audio. I don't know, like, because, and it's not, okay, the point isn't really what they do. It's the networks that are attached to them. Now, Facebook, I hardly use it all anymore. But the people that that I have as friends on Facebook are, you know, college friends, cousins, like family, you know, members, like siblings, and you know, a few other people. But I just follow people that I find their photographs interesting on Instagram. So I think the social aspect, the social graph aspect, it's not good because I can't see a scenario where they don't eventually connect those accounts telling you they're doing you a favor. You know, I think Facebook's going to take your Instagram, you know, friends or people you follow and maybe try to push their Facebook profiles on you. And it's something where I'm just happy looking at their photos. And, you know, if I ran into them somewhere and I talked to them, maybe I'd become friends with them and probably just, you know, email with them instead of Facebook. But if I, you know, if they added me on Facebook, like, that's fine. But I don't really, you know, see someone that's just somewhere else out in the world taking cool pictures as someone that, you know, that needs to be in a different network. It's fine that they're on Instagram. And I can't help but think that they're, because they're so obsessed with that whole social graph thing, they're going to jam those two things together.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think that, you know, maybe Facebook was a little sour that they were just becoming this push service for so many things. And probably, like, you know, you said earlier when we were talking, Instagram was probably a huge source of content being pushed to them, but that means that people weren't engaging and interacting and using their photo upload tool. And what they did then is they, like I think Google does, they prioritize and award you, and especially businesses, for playing by their rules and using their photo uploader. Not even, you know, using third-party things like CoTweet, you know, like certain other sites, when you try to integrate, you can only do so much. Even on mobile applications, you can only do so much. They really want you on the website where they can serve you ads. They can probably suck in a ton more information. You know, there's a lot more data that can be had, you know, on a computer versus on a mobile website. And, you know, now that they've bought Instagram, it'll just be really interesting to see what they do with it.
I think that you point out something. You point toward a real issue that you have to consider with Facebook and Instagram. You know, Facebook buying Instagram, and that Facebook is very much inherently a web application. It's a website, right? A web application, and Instagram was very much a mobile application, to the point where their website had very limited functionality. The app was designed to be used on your mobile device, on your iPhone for a while, then they opened it up to Android just recently.
Yeah, and you know what? I hope that Instagram can help them with their mobile, because Facebook does not have a share feature on their mobile app. You can like and you can comment on people's posts, but you can't share. And I just don't get that. I don't get why they don't have that feature.
They're not letting you get out of the site. They don't want you to get out of the site, right? And that's they're trying to push everything in there.
Share a post on your own wall.
Oh, well, there you go. I don't know if that's copyright or just bad design. No, it's just bad design, right? It's just limited functionality, because they're not caught up with the mobile space.
They just changed, you know, the bar so that you can hit like right from the bar. You don't have to go into the post, or I can't remember what it is, but I did notice that. I mean, it's easier to like things, but they're sort of like, just like it, you know, just like it instead of sharing it, engaging it. I guess my biggest complaint is that every mobile app that I use that also has a website pales in comparison, and it's very, very frustrating as a user. I think what a lot of people don't understand is that I don't care what device I'm on. I want the same or a better experience. I want an optimized experience for an iPad, but I want to be able to go to your real website. And there are some websites that just keep forcing you to their mobile version, and then they have Flash, and then I'm on my iPad and I can't use it. And it's just infuriating. And I mean, these are websites that I've been on from marketing companies that specialize in this, you know, like,
yeah,
no joke.
A lot of them probably built up a lot of knowledge about Flash. A lot of people are having a hard time letting that go. You know, Flash is something that I think is incredibly pernicious. Flash, I understand that there was a time when the web had certain limitations that Flash would allow people to get around, but the Flash website these days, like, first of all, people would put up Flash sites that are just gone now, or, you know, haven't been maintained. So a lot of archival sites will be part, you know, you go to older websites to see something, it'll be half Flash and mostly broken. And I actually use FlashBlock on Chrome, on Google Chrome, when I browse, because I can't stand Flash, and it's gotten so annoying now. It's gotten so unnecessary, and the sites that just continue to use it, that's crazy. But you know, if I can go back to Facebook really quick, what do you think about the, you know, how, like, I was just reading this article about how apparently there are a lot of people that don't really like the sharing that goes on now on Facebook that's automatic.
I've seen some embarrassing article shares,
yeah,
for sure.
There's an article that I was reading on theglobeandmail.com that was talking about how the writer had asked numerous people, and nobody had really had very positive things to say about all that automatic sharing. And like you said, people will actually share their articles, and it is very tricky how they do this, but people will share articles on their wall or whatever, and then people will see that in their newsfeed. They'll click on the article, but instead of, say, going to guardian.co.uk, you go to the Guardian's app. And then if you don't read the fine print, you don't realize that when you click yes, it is now tracking you every single time you read anything on that app. And probably on the Guardian website, if you're logged into Facebook, it will report that to everyone. Now, of course, if you're, I guess, you know, yeah, that's the thing, is people are going to see what you're reading, and I think maybe that should be private. Maybe you should be able to read whatever you want. Maybe if some people are into dumb celebrity stuff, they don't need to share that if they're trying to, if they have, like, a professional network on Facebook or something. And maybe people don't need to know, you know, how many articles I read about British politics, because, you know, I'm an American, you know, but I don't really care. But I actually think that, yeah, the sharing should be intentional. I actually have my readability list up. If you go to djmcloud.com, it's just there's a readability chair logo there, and that'll show you what I'm reading right now, or what I'm planning to read soon. But I'm happy to share that stuff, and if I didn't want to, I wouldn't put it on that. I wouldn't put it on that list, you know, and I think that the automatic sharing stuff, whether it's through what music people are listening to on Spotify or what articles they're reading on, you know, Huffington Post or whatever, it really is becoming something that I think people are getting annoyed with, but I don't know what the end game is here, because again, like, I'm not out of the mainstream of Facebook users, especially now. But what do you think? What do you think the end game is? This? Do you think people are going to stand for this? Like, having all the random stuff they read shared, and the really lack of transparency. A lot of people didn't realize that they signed up for this, that now whenever they look at an article, it's going to get transmitted.
So, depending on what generation you're in, I think you'll react differently. So people who are Gen Y, which is us, and Gen X and above, they're going to have some issues with it. Especially Gen X, and, you know, those are people in their later 30s to, you know, mid 40s or so, mid 50s. And they're going to have issues with that, because they grew up in a time and in an era where there was a lot more privacy, where there wasn't the internet, and they're sort of navigating this new landscape. For, you know, the generations below, Gen Y, so I don't even know what they're called.
What do they call them? Millennials?
Yeah, and I think there's a couple other ones. More and more, the research that I've seen is talking about how they have a different view of privacy. They're sort of like, so what if I read that article? You know, what are you going to do about it? Yeah, I read it, so what? You know, I think they're also smart enough to read the fine print, and I think they're the type that aren't going to accept the apps and just click like a lot of the Gen Xers and boomers, and they go through computers.
They just got themselves into it.
Exactly, and they just click away, whereas I think millennials are a little less trusting of that kind of stuff, so they're going to pick and choose where they sort of engage. But when they are engaging, they expect it to be shared with, because they're knowledgeable of the engagement, they're knowledgeable of the technology, and they want to share that. And they're not afraid if they're listening to Madonna. I think there's a little bit more of a confidence in that generation, and a little bit more of a coming to your true self and just being who you are and not trying to live in the era of the 50s and the 60s and the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, you know, like, all those generations had so many different identities to them. And I think a lot of the sort of 2000 plus is focused on, you know, creating your own identity. And there's still sort of trends that are recycling.
I don't mean to be cynical, but I think a lot of people are using very corporate approved means of expression to find this true identity in a lot of cases.
How so?
Well, I mean, if they're like, oh, I don't care if I read that article. What article are you talking about that they don't care that they read? You know what I mean? Is it some radical political thing? Actually, I got to give credit where it's due. There's a lot of very political minded, you know, very young people. But what I'm saying is, like, you know, just Facebook is one of those places that is sort of utterly conformizing tool. And I think that at least is my hypothesis, that the real intent of all this mega sharing is to control people by social shame. And maybe these millennials are over that, and that's great. I hope so. But we're talking about Gen Xers, Gen Y. Like,
That's the people who are upset about it.
Well, and that's the thing, is that there's this kind of sense of social shame. Like, so if you read a trashy article, or so you clicked on a picture, like does that really... Is there really anything that's that surprising these days, first of all? And is it really that big of a deal? But I think people are going to normalize their behaviors, their reading patterns. I think it's very dangerous, because on the outside, things people say and do a lot of times reflect their fear of being seen as different or out of step. But when people are in the privacy of their own homes, like, you know, maybe reading articles, why shouldn't they feel free to explore widely and even read bad articles to learn from bad articles and things like that. So I think that, yeah, this stuff, I put a lot of stuff out there on Twitter, on, you know, my website, on, you know, on in the public space, but I feel like, I think about what I share, and maybe not a lot and not too long, but I'm aware that I'm sharing. And this passive sharing thing, while I actually have hooked up, you know, my Last FM account has a lot of, like, the music I'm listening to. I don't know. I think, like, I definitely turn that on myself. So I'm fine with that. And I guess I'm very concerned about people having this thing turned on, not really knowing what to do about it, and then reacting kind of sheepishly and maybe censoring themselves as to what they even consume.
I like your theory. I think maybe you're giving them too much credit. I don't know that they're necessarily setting out to do social shame. I don't know how that benefits them. I think, and I don't know how much Facebook has in terms of saying, you know, like, you know, this article says Facebook's latest intrusive outrage apps that tell everyone what I'm reading. I don't know how much Facebook has involvement in those apps and how much the app developers have in that. I mean, I think it's, to me, it sounds like the app developers would set up the technology using Facebook to share everything. And it sounds like it'd be their decision, the app developers versus Facebook.
What happened last summer is that Facebook rolled out this concept called frictionless sharing. This is basically a doctrine they have. The companies are just plugging in to the system that Facebook set up.
Okay. That said, I think the specific reading apps and the people who are making the apps and the people who are plugging into Facebook systems don't understand it, and they just want to get a lot of app downloads and a lot of people reading stuff, and it's not really benefiting them from an advertising standpoint if they're just staying within the Facebook wall, the Facebook garden.
They might have a cooperative agreement with Facebook to have to get a share of the ads that Facebook serves in their app.
That's true.
Well, I'm gonna get us something to drink, and we'll take a little break. So you're listening to the DJMCloud.com podcast with me, Daniel J. McKeown, and with Jessica. You're on fire.
You don't even know why you're dressing that way, why you're wearing those glasses, why you're wearing skinny jeans. You're just doing it. And I think that the hipster 2.0, as you so wonderfully coined, is really annoying to people and children of, you know, an era where there was a rawness and a truth to things. And I think there's a lot of fakeness about media and art and creation.
Yeah, there was a culture of, like, authenticity in the 90s, even if it was a flawed culture of authenticity, and there was still the value put in authenticity, and the irony was different. How could that even be explained? But, like, the irony would have been so obvious, people would have kind of stepped into kind of an ironic, you know, moment, and then they would step out of it, and the transition would be very clear. And like you were saying just a minute ago that hipsters now, the hipsters 2.0, they don't really mean it, or they're not completely sincere about it. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but something like that.
They don't know why they're doing it. I think that's the biggest thing. So there's that insincerity there. They're jumping on a trend, and you know, luckily there's clothes and music and hairstyles and fashion to go along with it. So, you know, they can do it. But I think when you can walk into a Hot Topic store and buy, you know, clip-on pink hair, it's not the same as getting Kool-Aid and dyeing your hair red like I did, you know, like, or using Manic Panic and having a hot pink streak and you're like really dyeing your hair, you know, like there's this fakeness to it, hair extensions and, you know, so I think they're doing this now, but they're going to be ready to do the next thing. And I think this whole idea of, you know, back to Facebook and blogging and Twitter, it's there's a very big thing about instantaneous, what's going on right now, this moment.
Yeah,
so,
Twitter is very much like that. Yeah.
So there's people involved
Tumblr
in this sort of cultures, exactly. It's, well, this is what's cool and hip right now, so this is what I'm going to be, this is what I'm going to talk about, and this is the shows and the music I'm going
to
listen
and it's
to.
So easy to share, retweet, or and Tumblr is a reblog, do you think there's something about that, like a contrast with, say, early blogging, and I mean, you know, 2002 to 2008 or so, like, or, you know, like blogging before, you know, the enormous popularity of Twitter and other things, and the way where people used to have shorter blog posts sometimes, like, and then they would have longer ones. Now a blog is usually a place for more long form, typically, although there's a lot of different stuff still out there. But do you think that there's a difference between reblogging something on Tumblr and actually, you know, being the one to take the picture, or that's in the picture, or that wrote the post?
I think it's a little bit of a laziness. So what are the younger generations really contributing?
Well, I think a lot of them are very creative, though. I mean, a lot of them are making this stuff, but then a bunch of people are like the echo chamber. So instead of sending links, you reblog, because you instead of being in email, your friends are in the Tumblr you know, administration panel, and they see new posts popping up. So it's like you're pushing that content you discovered out to your followers, and that's a big thing, right? Is the big buzzword curation on the web, and I don't know, you know, if that's really maybe cracked up to the hype from a year or two ago. But I mean, I don't know. I think that a lot of people, there's a lot more people expressing themselves than there used to be, and you can't expect everyone to actually be especially creative. You can't expect everyone to have a lot of ideas that are very much their own. So maybe, you know, like, of course, old school blogging would be a lot of grabbing other people's text and linking, you know, and then maybe linking to the story at the bottom or something like that. And now maybe that's evolved into a lot of, like, photos and stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, a lot of people aren't creating stuff, and they have the computer there. They have a camera or a camera phone. They could be creating. And you know, I don't know how you encourage that, because that would be kind of cool if people would have more of their own stuff in their feeds.
I just think if you go and you look at the hashtags on Twitter and the trending topics...
Oh, no, that's
terrible. I'm going to be a bitch if...
Yeah, you know,
you know,
to be fair, they censor those, because how many WikiLeaks ones were in there when that story was breaking really big, you know, in the last couple of years? They definitely shape and censor those, probably even try to skew them younger. I'm just saying, I think that there's some interference in that, but even still, yes, it's unbelievable that anyone is doing some of these hashtags. But I guess it seems like immaturity to me, I guess. And maybe you're a desperate search for good comic material. There are so many terrible comedians on the web.
Well, so I think, you know, part of the alter hyper ironistic sort of state that we're in, you know, a big part of comedy is irony. And I think it's just so over the top, right? Because somebody got a piece of research that said Gen X and Gen Y and millennials, they know when when you're not being authentic. And so you need to be authentic, but connect with them. So Sprite does a commercial that says, obey your thirst, like Sprite.
The
you
fact
know?
That, and I think Sprite is, it's almost kind of like, it's very strange. It's almost clever in a very twisted way to actually, and they've done, that's been around for a while. So Sprite has had the amazing marketing message of, you know how you define yourself as an individual and go your own way? Drink this mass-produced, carbonated, high fructose corn syrup containing product.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, there's so many examples. I think I was listening, like, you know, all the insurance commercials, tried to bring a personification to their brands, and, you know, Dos Equis and Old Spice, and, you know, even things like College Humor, you know, just this, again, this so over the top sort of outlandish type.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Will Ferrell and all those sort of his new gang of the Rat Pack and all those movies, you know, with Ben Stiller and the Owen brothers. I mean, they're all ridiculous.
Oh, yeah, and there's
what
about Adam Sandler's shop? I mean, he makes one terrible movie after another involving still working with Rob Schneider, David Spade. He's awful, washed up. Guys like I guess Spade has some talent, I think, a little. You know, Schneider, still kicking around. Like, I mean, you know, Kevin James sometimes does movies with him, but actually, you know, I mean, that guy can be funny sometimes. But I mean, it's just, like, they have made, you know, Sandler, I think I was talking to you about how what an event, certainly in mid-Michigan, it was when The Waterboy came out. You know, Adam Sandler had Happy Gilmore and Billy Madison. He was so big, and it just, you know, I went to see it with some friends, and people just, you know, it's so much buzz, you know. I mean, Sandler was so big then, you know. I didn't know this was, like, you know, when I was in college, but I was in college at the time, and both, you know, and that was, a little over a decade now. He just keeps making stuff. I mean, have you heard of Grown Ups? You know, I think everybody heard about Jack and Jill because that was just so bad. But
Gross.
There's more stuff that goes by that's just a really, you know, mediocre, bad comedy that no one even pays attention to, like Grown Ups or something.
Everybody Wants to Be a Woman. I just think there's just
that
so
Jack
many...
and Jill, yeah, that's been talked about as one of the worst movies ever made, but I'd say.
So, if I were to put my sort of media history hat on, what I would say is when they showed cartoons before the war footage at the movies, I think that's the kind of era we're in again. We want this overdone, over-comical, so outlandish. We know it's not real.
Mm.
We want to escape reality, but we want to know that our reality is so far escaped because reality sucks. Job market sucks. The war sucks. Politics suck. You know, like, there's so many big, hard things that the country and the world
yeah.
are dealing with that we seek out this vapid, empty, you know, comical, over-the-topness. It's like a circus, you know, it's the circus, it's the cartoons of its era, because we need that escape for some reason as human beings, where we just need to go into pretend land for a while.
Do we need that?
I think there's something probably deeply psychological about that. I mean, we keep seeming to repeat that pattern as a race, you know?
I think that a lot of consumption of content and cultural matters are very carefully regulated by the 1%, and I don't know. I think, like, you know, I think that a lot of stuff is just. A lot of stuff is mind control. From Sesame Street is not teaching kids actual. I mean, it's strange, distracting visuals that don't actually teach kids very much at all. But what you know what Sesame Street teaches kids? It teaches kids to watch TV. And people are trained from being babies that to be addicted to television. So I don't know. I mean, but you're talking about something bigger. You're talking about the shape, the archetypes of the culture, whatever form they take, whether people are reading books, watching TV, going to plays. It's going to reflect that to some extent, I guess, is what you're saying, especially youth culture. And how could that be? You know, I mean, is it? There's a lot of borrowing from the 80s in fashion, right?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of unfortunate borrowing, I think. But I think that when... Yeah, I like bright colors. I don't mind that. I think a lot of the way things are cut and designed are like cliched 80s looks are bad cliched 80s looks to me. But, you know, it's fine. You know, people got to, you know, try different stuff, I guess. What are the real parallels to the 80s? Do you know what I mean? Like, the 80s were a time of... there were some recessions, but there was a lot of superficial growth because that was when the country started borrowing like crazy. You know, the private and public sector both started borrowing enormously, and creating a lot of the debt issues we have now. But at the time, there was a boom because of all this, a combination of, there wasn't a boom. I mean, it was actually a lot of recessions involved, right? And a stock market crash in the late 80s. But there was this superficial boom. There's a boom mentality. You know, Reagan was in office, and, you know, a lousy Republican. Obama's in office now, who's a mediocre Democrat, but certainly, I think, better. I think, like, you're talking about, you know, a lot of the deregulation and financial shenanigans, the junk bonds. I mean, a lot of stuff today is junk bonds by any standard, because a lot of companies are doing so badly that their debt isn't worth a lot, you know. But the whole junk bond culture in the 80s, leverage buyouts, I mean, that never really went away, but that's come back into, you know, high profile with these, you know, private equity groups, Texas Pacific Group, KKR, all these very big, powerful private equity groups. And then, you know, like the Chinese Sovereign Wealth Fund. I mean, that you know, these are huge, you know, entities that are controlling large amounts of American stock shares and other assets that aren't reportable to a board of directors and to shareholders. And they're often not even based in the U.S. And I mean, I guess I'm kind of going on a tangent, but yeah, it is a lot of interesting ways in which this era does not resemble the 80s. Even to the extent of, like, the kind of flag-waving idiot patriotism of the 80s is not really that prevalent these days.
Well, and I think, you know, I think my comment was more around wartime. So I wonder if it's something to do with wartime and maybe combined with financial crisis. Usually those two go hand in hand, one before the other, you know. But... I don't know if it's something more to that sort of degree. Like, you feel so pressured, you feel so... But I don't know. I mean, because the war in Iraq/Afghanistan, I don't know that the youth generation really cares about it.
Maybe they're trying to
sort of escape on a deeper level, and maybe it's more an economic thing.
I think it is. I think there's a lot more concern about the economy, but... I mean, if you look back, the Afghanistan war drags on, but it started in 2001. The Iraq war is a lot of it's over. I mean, Iraq has many problems now, but they're mostly problems with Iraqis versus Iraqis. And we, you know, the United States doesn't have the presence that it did a few years ago. There's certainly still some presence there. But in Afghanistan, it's still a shooting war, for sure. A very, you know... begrudging battle with the Taliban, kind of on and off, but very, very violent. And then now all these Americans committing these terrible atrocities, you know, overseas, pissing on dead bodies, massacring, you know, Afghans and their villages. It is just appalling. But I think that there's such an economic crisis at home, and I think if you look at like some of the ideology of like the Occupy movement and stuff, and of course there's many different directions that stuff goes, and a lot of it is just sort of like the new left looking for a new home. But there are some relatively new ideas, and they tend to just really connect things now. Like Dick Cheney and people like that really made it easy for the average person at home to say, wow, there's like a cabal of rich, powerful people, you know, people involved in the oil and banking industries that seem to kind of underwrite these wars, that, you know, that then profit from them. And, you know, we have these very obvious, you know, war criminals running the country. I think people realize that then at the end, right, George W. Bush gives that huge bailout to the banks. It's all so connected, and I think that's what people that are very young, that's what they've seen, is they've seen the nexus of crooked politics and just what seems like an endless war. Because if you were really young and you're like in college now, the Afghan war and the Iraq war were starting, you know, 9 years ago. And that goes, you know, if you've just become an adult, that goes very far back into your childhood. And it seems like most of your life, or a lot of your life, has just been this permanent state of war. That's something definitely to be concerned about. I think that, I know we were looking at, we were talking about books, and, you know, I haven't read it, but Rachel Maddow has that book where she talks about how easy it is to go to war now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's a really interesting point, actually, that, you know, growing up with technology, but also growing up in a state of war, I think this hyper-ironistic sort of media content creation could be, you know, an effect of that. And I guess I'm curious as to what, you know, what is causing this, because I don't know that I've ever seen anything like this in all the media that I've sort of researched, to this level, to this extent, to this over-the-topness. And I think in so many mediums, you know, in advertising, in TV shows, in radio, in internet, in blog post, I mean, just, it's just everywhere. And for me, actually, it's sort of annoying. You know, it's sort of like, I don't relate to it. I don't understand it. I know that it's ironic, and I know that you know it's ironic. So why are we doing this? Why can't we create something that's authentic and true and real and filled with passion and love and excitement instead of this fakeness?
You know what? I couldn't agree with you more, I don't think, about that point, because I think, you know, that's my position, is that communication should be very direct, very straightforward. And even in daily interactions, people are often convoluted and, I dare say, pretentious in the way they communicate. I think that direct communication of the ideas that need to be sent, you know, to the intended audience, that person you're talking to, or wherever the communication is going, the less noise you put in the channel, I think the better. Well, it's been great talking to you, Jessica, thanks for listening to the podcast. You can see more podcasts and show notes at djmcloud.com. This has been podcast number 31, recorded April 12th, 2012.